This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Turkish military officials say their troops are ready to launch a long-planned incursion into Syria to take out Kurdish forces branded by Ankara as terrorist, but viewed by much of the West as key partners in the fight against the Islamic State terror group. Earlier Tuesday, Turkey placed a series of rocket launchers and artillery along the border with Syria, while military officials had said that they would not allow the creation of what they called a terror corridor along the Turkish border. Meanwhile, VOA's Lattice Ahok tells us the Kurds are frantically preparing.
Kurdish fighters wounded in the successful offensive against Islamic State in Syria demonstrated Tuesday in Kamishli, a northern Syrian town close to the border with Turkey. The U.S.-backed Kurdish militia is a member of the Syrian Democratic Forces, an alliance of groups that fought terrorist groups and Turkey-backed militias in the region. Ankara claims that Syrian Kurds want to join Turkey's Kurdish minority with the goal of carving out territory for an independent Kurdistan and is determined to remove them from the border area. Local Kurds are on high alert.
That's VOA's Lattice Ahok reporting. The White House says it will not participate in what it calls the unconstitutional impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. In addition, as AP correspondent Jackie Quinn explains, the Trump administration is arguing that grand jury testimony should remain secret since the House hasn't voted to hold an official impeachment inquiry.
The Justice Department has argued judicial proceedings take place in court, not in Congress. Also, a Trump administration lawyer argues that Democrats have had a shifting rationale about why they need the documents. Democrats say the materials are needed for the impeachment inquiry to further investigate what President Trump knew or said about Russian interference in the 2016 election.
And that is AP's Jackie Quinn, and this is VOA News. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee has issued a bipartisan report that calls on the U.S. government and private industry to prevent social media sites from being used to interfere in the 2020 presidential election as they were in 2016. The report, released Tuesday after more than 2 years of investigating foreign electoral meddling, found the Kremlin-backed Internet Research Agency sought to influence the 2016 U.S. presidential election by harming Hillary Clinton's chances of success in supporting Donald Trump at the direction of the Kremlin. The finding is consistent with evidence uncovered by the U.S. intelligence community after the 2016 election in which Trump defeated Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. The United States is imposing visa restrictions on the Chinese government and Communist Party officials who are believed to be responsible for the detention or abuse of the Uyghurs, Muslim ethnic minorities in China. A State Department official told VOA Tuesday that visa records are confidential under U.S. law. Therefore, the State Department will not discuss or disclose individual applications of this policy. Meanwhile, despite a spike in tensions between the U.S. and China, trade talks will go on as scheduled, AP correspondent Mike Hempen.
China is demanding the Trump administration lift its latest sanctions on tech companies that develop facial recognition and other artificial intelligence technology. The U.S. says that technology is being used to repress Muslims in northwest China. China's foreign ministry says the U.S. is interfering in Chinese affairs. Despite the criticism, China's Ministry of Commerce says the vice premier and other officials will be in Washington Thursday for talks. Mike Hemp in Washington.
The UN Secretary General warned Tuesday that the organization is facing its deepest deficit of the decade and might not be able to pay all its staff in November. Antonio Guterres said that the cash flow problem is so steep that without spending cuts he puts in place in January, the organization would not have been able to pay for last month's meeting of the General Assembly for its annual debate, which was attended by world leaders. By the end of September, member states had only paid only 70% of the total assessment for the regular budget, compared to 78% at the same time last year. Of the organization's 193 member states, 129 have paid in full, totaling $1.99 billion toward the regular budget of just over $3 billion. Approximately $1.3 billion is outstanding for the year 2019. The United States is among the 64 countries that has yet to pay its dues in full. It is also the largest contributor to the UN's regular budget. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October the 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president says he is the duly elected leader of the country despite a court challenge.
We had an election, and that the Malawi Electoral Commission duly declared the winner, and that the winner is the existence of the president, Professor African Tadika. That is a fact.
Gemi Kalilani is spokesperson for President Peter Mutharika. A Malawi charity addresses funding shortage for primary education. The UN Security Council again urges all South Sudan parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement. And Kenya queries the United Nations for failure to declare Al-Shabaab a terror organization.
Everybody within the region understands that Al-Shabaab is a terror group that need to be fought left, right, and center. We need to secure our borders, especially in preventing this terror group.
Ditmouth Barasa is a member of Kenya's Parliamentary Security Committee, and there is an urgent need for a boost in HIV-TB funding worldwide, including 8 African countries. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawian President Peter Mutharika says he won the May 21st presidential election and that the opposition and their supporters should accept him as their leader. He called on the opposition and human rights groups to abandon militancy in dealing with political differences and to join him in building Malawi. President Mutharika made the comments Tuesday during his first political rally in the opposition stronghold of Msondwe. A court is hearing a case brought by the opposition Malawi Congress Party and the United Transformation Movement Party, alleging electoral fraud. There were clashes before the president's rally between residents of Msondwe and police, and the police say one of their officers died after being beaten. Ngemi Kalilani is spokesperson for Malawi President Peter Mutharika.
The president assured the people of Malawi that he is in charge of the country, and he would make sure that peace prevails in the country. But before that, the president asked all the people that were on the rally to stand up for 1 minute in honor of a Malawi Police Service officer who had been murdered midday in a rural community called Nsungwe in rural Lilongwe.
Who killed the police officer? And what about this report that the police also attacked those protesting?
Well, we have a location in Malawi. It is called Nsungwe. The location is near the main capital city, Lilongwe, the CBD, just a couple of hours from the capital city. And with, for lack of a better term, it's a hotbed for the opposition Malawi Congress Party. Now, what has been happening for the past 3 months or so is that the Malawi Congress Party has been mobilizing thugs from this area of Lilongwe, ferrying them in lorries to the capital city in Lilongwe to cause mayhem in the name of demonstrations. Most of the people that are doing these various demonstrations are normally ferried from this part of Lilongwe rural. Now, what happened is that when there was an announcement that the president would hold a rally in Lilongwe, as usual, the community from this area mobilized themselves and started blocking roads. Apparently, to stop people from this area from traveling to the city center to attend the president's rally. So they erected illegal roadblocks on several points in that location. So the police were and started blocking vehicles that wanted to use that road to go to the wrong way and started causing mayhem, stopping vehicles that dared to resist their actions. So it was in the course of this fracas that the police was deployed to quell the situation and make sure that there was peace that side. And it was in this process of them trying to bring peace to that area that the community started storming the police. So it was in the course of that action that the one police officer sustained deep wounds, which resulted in his death.
As you said, the president, in addressing the rally, said that he was elected, referring to the May 21st election, that he was elected, and that the opposition should accept him as the president of the country. Some people will say, why should he say that when the case about the election results?
It doesn't take away the fact that we had an election and that the Malawi Electoral Commission declared the winner, and that the winner is His Excellency the President, Professor Hifikepunye Tarika. That is a fact. It has not been successfully challenged in any way. So the status quo remains. There is absolutely nothing wrong in the President stating what is factual. Yes, we all know there is a court case at the moment. The opposition is disputing the result of the election. But the fact that someone is disputing the election doesn't mean that the result of the election does not stand as we speak. The election result stands.
I spoke earlier this week with Archbishop Msusa of Blantyre. Apparently, the Archbishop and his group are involved in some kind of a dialogue initiative. He indicated that they have met with the president. What's the view from the president's standpoint in terms of how the dialogue is going?
The president has been welcoming to the idea of the Public Affairs Committee headed by Msusa to initiate dialogue between different sides. And from what they had discussed, what we heard from the Public Affairs Committee was that they felt it was important that they needed to meet the other stakeholders. I've just been told that they have completed their round of engagement and soon they'll be asking to meet the president for feedback.
Ngemi Kalilani is the spokesman for Malawi President Peter Mutharika. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Malawi is struggling to provide the free primary education to children it promised 25 years ago. Teachers say they were not prepared for massive rise in student enrollment, leaving schools without adequate infrastructure, teachers and supplies. Charities have stepped in to address the problem, as Lamek Masina reports from Nkatabe District in northern Malawi.
Dina Malenga is the only fourth grade teacher at Mazembe Primary School in Malawi's Nkatabe District. She teaches 112 students, almost double the recommended 60 per teacher. She says it is too hectic for me as a teacher. Since there are so many students, they don't easily grasp what I'm teaching them, and some don't even finish assignments. Tracking those who do not finish their assignments is another tough job to do. Malenga is among teachers struggling with impact of Malawi's policy on free primary education. The government introduced the policy in 1994 to curb illiteracy, but did not provide adequate funding. Teachers say the resulting influx of students has reduced the quality of education. Leonard Manta is the head teacher at Mazembe Primary School.
This is the situation with the free primary because so many teachers are registering, I mean, so many learners are registering, but we don't have enough teachers to teach those learners in primary schools.
Western charities like Ripple Africa have stepped in to help address the resource challenges. The charity is supporting six primary schools in Nkatabe with donated desks, classroom, and teacher housing construction. Dan Shawa is in charge of education projects at Ripple Africa.
Our aim behind this is that we want to make sure that this community here, the children should do well up to university level, so that they should be self-sustainable rather than relying to Ripple Africa or relying for someone's help, because education is the key to everything.
The charity is also paying salaries for trainee primary school teachers who are not on the government payroll, like Isaac Mangani Banda.
At least my life has been much changed, so I'm able to support my family, although the salaries which I get is a little, but the little debt is enough to support what? My family.
Ripple Africa says it plans to raise more funds to double the number of Malawi primary schools it is supporting and further ease the burden on teachers. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Nkatabe, Malawi.
Today's Wednesday, October the 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The UN Security Council has again urged all South Sudan parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement. In a statement on Tuesday, approved by all 15 members, the council called on the parties to quickly implement the transitional security arrangements and to agree on internal political boundaries. The parties have until November November 12 to form a transitional government of national unity. The council also called on those that have yet to sign the peace agreement to seek a political resolution to their concerns. One of those groups that have not signed the peace deal is the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. Kwaje Lasu is the spokesperson for the alliance.
One of the things that we are not part of this agreement is a host of issues. For example, the issue of federalism. That is intentionally being omitted. However, in the preamble of this agreement, it is stated that there is a demand of the people of South Sudan. Also, we demanded the lean government, considering the fact that the country is in a total state of economic disaster. We wanted to have a lean government. However, Juba wanted to maintain a bigger government. We were really concerned the issue of constitution for the Republic of South Sudan. Our concern was it was going to be a one-sided constitution that would not represent the aspiration of the people of South Sudan, who have fought tooth and nail, cemented their blood for the interests of the people of South Sudan as the country.
The UN Security Council is urging progress in the peace process, particularly is calling on parties that have not signed the peace agreement to renounce violence and seek a political resolution.
We are signatory to the cessation of hostility agreement that was signed in December 2017. And up to this moment, we have been abiding by the cessation of hostility. However, our forces have been attacked across South Sudan, and we have no choice but to defend ourselves and our territory.
November is coming, and this is the deadline for the revitalized peace agreement to be implemented. I know you're not part of the agreement. Are you optimistic that this will happen?
My brother, it's not a matter of optimism or pessimism. It is a matter of analyzing objectively the whole agreement. Quite honestly, the revitalized peace agreement was a coerced agreement that was forced to the people of South Sudan, have no interest but the interests of the elite who are participating in the peace agreement. So we categorically reject the agreement based on those principles. We wanted an agreement that can be inclusive, representing the voices of the people of South Sudan. As far as this is November 12th, we knew that that's not going to happen. So Juba will not implement this agreement. They have done their best to torpedo this agreement through withholding the funding to exercise items that were agreed on, for example, the security arrangements as well as the issue of states. Notwithstanding the fact that Juba have no any political will to maintain their violent kleptocratic group in Juba under the leadership of President Kiir.
The fact you are not part of this revitalized peace agreement, what are you to the people of South Sudan?
Well, I have to be very frank with you. As we speak, South Sudan Opposition Movement Alliance is the hope of the people of South Sudan that can deliver them from the kleptocratic regime of President Kiir, that can usher in an inclusive, lasting peace in our country, that can usher in a true democratic transformation for the country and the people of South Sudan. Therefore, we have a vast support and majority within and without South Sudan, as well as the diaspora. Our position is lasting peace, justice and accountability, and democratic transformation for our country.
Kwaje Lasu is the spokesman for the South Sudan Opposition Alliance. Kenya has complained about the decision of the United Nations not to formally declare the militant group Al-Shabaab a terror organization. Speaking during a two-day security workshop in Nairobi, Kenya's National Assembly Speaker Justin Muturi said Al-Shabaab is at liberty to receive funding from non-governmental organizations, even as the group terrorized Kenya and Somalia. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Kenya has earlier urged the international community to hasten the listing of Al-Shabaab as a terrorist organization under the United Nations Security Council Resolution 1267 of 1999 after multiple attacks in Somalia and Kenya early this year. National Assembly Speaker Justin Muturi, who was chairing the security workshop that brought together diplomats from across the world, said that the United Nations should consider Kenya's plea of having Al-Shabaab declared a terror group.
To the extent that it continues to be considered as a legitimate group of human rights crusaders in Somalia, then they are at liberty to receive financing from all sources, including from civil society groups and NGOs.
Kenya has been at the forefront of peacekeeping in the East African region since her soldier left for Somalia on AMISOM mission in 2011. The U.S. ambassador to Kenya, Kyle McCutter, said that Kenya's request would affect the human rights in Somalia and that the United States would not support.
The request from Kenya was Resolution 1267, which includes in it the removal of humanitarian and care for Somalia. This is an issue to the compassionate people of the United States. We have instead supported and have over many years UN Security Resolution 751 declaring that Al-Shabaab were terrorists.
Kenya's Foreign Affairs Minister Monica Juma's call for the listing of the Somali-based group came against the backdrop of a multi-agency operation in search of Cuban doctors abducted from Mandera County Referral Hospital on April 12th this year by the Al-Shabaab. Actions that the Foreign Office termed as deliberate violation of international humanitarian law. A member of the Security Committee in Kenya's Parliament, Didmas Barasa, insists that Al-Shabaab should be fought to secure the country.
Everybody within the region understands that Al-Shabaab is a terror group that need to be fought left, right and center. And there is no excuse. We need to secure our borders. We need to change our tact, especially in preventing this terror group. As members of parliament, we are willing to review any legislation that will hinder them from exercising their duties to protect this country from terrorism.
On the other hand, the director of the Kenya National Counterterrorism Center, Ambassador Martin Kimani, says Kenya's push was declined by the United Nations since it could have forced most countries bring in more laws to bear against the Al-Shabaab.
And Kenya, in November of 2018 and March of this year, pushed forward the listing of Al-Shabaab. And what this would have done is it would have forced globally more countries to bring their countering of terrorism financing laws and institutions bear against Al-Shabaab and those who fund it.
More than 30 people have been killed this year alone in Kenya, including foreigners and security officers, following attacks by the Al-Shabaab. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The International Organization for Migration reports fatalities from a shipwreck Monday off the coast of the Italian island of Lampedusa has pushed the migrant death toll on the Mediterranean Sea this year to 1,071. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The boat, which capsized 7 miles from the coast of Lampedusa, reportedly departed from Tunisia with between 50 and 55 people aboard. Some of the 22 survivors of the crash testified passengers included 15 Tunisians as well as West African migrants. Authorities say the Italian Coast Guard has recovered 13 bodies, all of them women, who came from Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, and Guinea. International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman says 17 migrants remain missing, including more women and at least 2 children. He says the missing are believed to be nationals of Ivory Coast, Cameroon, Guinea-Conakry, and Tunisia.
IOM's Missing Migrants Project reported Monday that these deaths bring to 15,750 the total number of dead on this particular central Mediterranean route since 1 January 2014. This is approximately 10 times the total lost on the Mediterranean's eastern corridor linking the Middle East to Greece, and almost the same multiple of all deaths on the western route linking North Africa to Spain.
Weather conditions reportedly were bad when the overloaded vessel, an unseaworthy wooden boat, set sail from Tunisia. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Charlie Yaxley says this tragic loss of life was predictable. He says once again, people anxious to reach Europe put their lives in the hands of smugglers and traffickers whose only interest is to make money.
We cannot continue to allow these criminals to act with impunity and to allow them to prey on people's misery and desperation by taking people's services for under these false promises.
He actually says the UNHCR is calling for a redoubling of efforts to identify those individuals responsible for this carnage and hold them accountable for their actions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
According to a new report out by Medecins Sans Frontieres, there is an urgent need for a boosting HIV-TB funding in 9 countries worldwide, 8 of those in Africa. Dr. Maria Guevara, an author of the report's research on Eswatini, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the dire needs in that country.
Eswatini probably carries one of the highest prevalences of HIV as well as TB in the world, right? So you have 27.4% of adults living with HIV. That's big.
So more than one in four people in Eswatini is living with HIV, is HIV positive?
Yes. So they have population is about 1.2 million inhabitants, and 27.4% is living with HIV. So that's a good bit. So let's say that's about 30%. Even though they've made some great progress in the last few years, I mean, there's still a huge number. That the progress is because they've been able to scale up treatment. But that treatment is obviously tenuous when that's not continued, right? And the thing is, there is a, what they are seeing, a youth bulge. There's a disproportionate prevalence or incidence seen more in women.
I was going to ask if it was if there was a gender gap.
There is. So the disparity in prevalence by sex is definitely more pronounced in the young. So there's the youth bulge I mentioned, so 15 to 24 years. And the incidence for adults of those between those ages is more in women, like 1.7%, than men, which is 1%.
What's the explanation, you think, for this, the higher rate in women?
I think it's sociocultural. So obviously the men are working, they have more access to care, and women are, you know, at the young age are culturally already getting, not necessarily married, but, you know, get out there with in the...
Do they have less say in protection, for example, if in relationships often and things like that?
There is a bit of that. I mean, it's also a multi-partner kind of culture, so women obviously are more exposed to that. Yeah, and they're also probably, even though the education is obviously trying to reach out to everybody, there's also that low exposure to public services.
And when it comes to TB, is there also this gender gap?
Well, so it depends how you see it. So the people who contract TB, 70% are HIV positive, right? So they have probably 308 per 100,000 persons in 2017 as their TB incidence rate, which is high. So, and then about 4% of these have multi-drug resistant TB also.
That was Dr. Maria Guevara, author of a recent report on HIV and TB in Eswatini. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Geneva. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Malawian President Peter Mutharika says he won the May 21st presidential election and that the opposition and their supporters should accept him as their leader. He called on the opposition and human rights groups to abandon militancy in dealing with political differences and to join him in building Malawi. President Mutharika made the comments Tuesday during his first political rally in the opposition stronghold of Msondwe. A court is hearing a case brought by the opposition Malawi Congress Party and the United Transformation Movement Party alleging electoral fraud. There were clashes before the president's rally between residents of Msondwe and police, and the police say one of their officers died after being beaten. The UN Security Council has again urged all South Sudan parties to implement the revitalized peace agreement. In a statement on Tuesday approved by all 15 members, the council called on the parties to quickly implement a transitional security arrangement and to agree on internal political boundaries. The parties have until November 12 to form a transitional government of national unity. The council also called on those that have yet to sign the peace agreement to seek a political resolution to their concerns. That is it for this Wednesday, October the 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Carl Sterling, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour. Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.